الشعب وبدنا نشيل على بشر وبهم متنا القوية سوريا بدها سوريا بدها وبدنا نشيل على بشر وبهم متنا القوية سوريا بدها سوريا بدها وبدنا نشيل على بشر وبهم متنا القوية سوريا بدها سوريا بدها. Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing. And joining us now is Daniel Byman, who is a professor in the Security Studies program at Georgetown University and the research director at the Brookings Institution Center for Middle East Policy. He served on the 9/11 Commission staff and is the author of A High Price, The Triumphs and Failures of Israel's Counterterrorism. He has an article at the New York Times, Mr. Obama, Don't Draw That Line. Welcome to Background Briefing, Daniel Byman.
Thank you for having me.
And according to the New York Times on Sunday, front page story, the president sort of went a little bit off the reservation when he issued that red line, that even his aides now leaking to the New York Times, that they were pretty alarmed by what he said. What do you make of that development?
In hindsight, this makes a lot of sense. The president was told, or decided, I should say, that the United States should press Syria not to use chemical weapons, but on his own went a bit too far and took some points that were meant to be a bit vague and made them much more concrete. And in doing so, put himself and the United States in a bit of a box.
And as you point out in your article in the New York Times, Mr. Obama, don't draw that line. There are reasons to do this and there are reasons not to do it. So let's start with the reasons to do it. In other words, if you warn the other side not to do something, that acts as a deterrent. And, of course, the problem is if they go ahead and do it, then they call you bluff. But in the first instance, did it make sense to deter the Syrians?
It makes sense to want to deter the Syrians from using chemical weapons. But in the end, if the United States is not going to do anything if they do use chemical weapons, we end up with the worst of both worlds. Syria will have used chemical weapons, and U.S. credibility for deterring behavior elsewhere, whether in Syria or with a country like Iran, is diminished.
So, but were the Russians the audience for that remark as much as Assad? I mean, isn't there been an assumption on our part that the Russians have some sway over the Assads, which may well be exaggerated?
I think the assumption was that Assad and also his allies within the Syrian elite were the primary audience, but also allies like Iran and like Russia. And this, I think, should be a wake-up call that while Russia is certainly Assad's friend, it doesn't control Assad, and he does what he wants, unfortunately.
So, of course, the calculus has changed quite a lot in the last 48 hours or so. So Friday night, 3 a.m., the Israelis bombed a military facility at Damascus International Airport. And then Sunday night, again, in the pre-dawn hours, the Israelis bombed facilities of the Revolutionary Guards in Mount Qasiyun that overlooks Damascus. So how much do you think that the red line over the chemical weapons issue and a possible limited use of sarin that's yet to be proven, how much has that sort of faded now because of what's just happened?
Certainly the Israeli strikes have grabbed a lot of attention, and unfortunately there'll be other horrors or interventions in Syria that are going to make the news and, I'll say, dampen the focus on chemical weapons. Also, the Obama administration, in my view, is likely to try to take a few steps in the coming weeks that are symbolic but are meant to be efforts to show that it is indeed trying to ratchet up pressure.
Well, our first guest today, who's a Syrian specialist at the National Defense University, Murhaf Joujati, and his sister is the English language spokesperson for the Syrian opposition. He was telling us that what's really starting to happen now is Plan B. In other words, the regime is going to, and the Alawites are going to retreat to the northwest into the ancestral mountains of the Alawites. And that was what that ethnic cleansing that took place with a Sunni village the other day was a sort of precursor for what's going to happen. So if he's correct and that the country is starting to literally not so much fall apart, but, you know, separate regionally and territorially into what could be a long-standing war. I guess the point I'm trying to make in a roundabout way is that the jeopardy of the chemical weapons is just going to get worse as this thing goes along, isn't it? I mean, there's no way in the world that the chemical weapons issue is going away. It's just going to get worse, isn't it?
That's absolutely correct. The most likely scenario, should Assad fall, is not that you'll have a benign, peaceful opposition take power and then consolidate rule, but rather that Syria might fall apart. And there are about a dozen different scenarios for how it might do so. But in almost all of these, the control of chemical weapons becomes very troubling. The weapons are in different parts of Syria. It's likely that different commanders or different rebel groups will control certain stockpiles. There's concern that groups like Hezbollah or more al-Qaeda-type groups like Jabhat al-Nusra will acquire some of these weapons. So this is a problem that's going to get worse, not one that's going to go away.
So is Israel trying to get the U.S. into this war? I mean, I noticed that the former head of military intelligence, speaking to Israel Radio, in a there's no mincing words. He was really basically saying, you know, we in Israel, we establish a red line with Iran and we stick by it, unlike the Americans. He didn't say that, but I mean, the implication was pretty strong that we're getting a little squishy on the red line. Is there more to that? Is Israel trying to force our hand here?
I don't think so. Israel is very conflicted when it comes to Syria. Bashar al-Assad is an enemy. He's supported terrorist groups against Israel. He's seen as hostile, and they definitely would relish seeing him fall. But on the other hand, what comes after Bashar might be worse, and Israel is very aware of that. The border with Syria has been quiet since 1974, and they're very concerned about the spread of chemical weapons. They're very concerned about the growth of radicalism and, in general, the anarchy on their border. So Israel feels there's a damned if you do, damned if you don't quality to whatever happens in Syria. I should further add that Israel often draws red lines and then often ignores them. It repeatedly drew some in Lebanon that it only enforced haphazardly. It's done so with Hamas. So certainly the Obama administration and the United States in general is not alone in drawing red lines that it doesn't live up to.
Again, I'm speaking with Daniel Beiman, who is a professor in the Security Studies program at Georgetown University and a research director at the Brookings Institution's Center for Middle East Policy. He's the author of A High Price, The Triumphs and Failures of Israeli Counterterrorism, and has an article at the New York Times, Mr. Obama, Don't Draw That Line. But how do you think, Daniel Beiman, this preemptive strategy of Israel, which is sort of trying to bomb every attempt that Hezbollah has Assad's have of transferring weapons to Hezbollah, and Hezbollah in turn getting them out of Syria? There was a bombing of convoy taking Russian surface-to-air missiles last January, and then there was the bombing on Friday at Damascus Airport. Supposedly, these were Scuds and this Iranian missile, but the extent to which the Revolutionary Guard barracks and facilities on Mount Qasayun, right near the palace that sits on top of the mountain and very much where Assad's brother, Maher, runs his operations, that seems to be a separate issue. But focusing on Hezbollah, can the Israelis successfully, by air, stop the transfer of weapons and, at the end of the day, chemical weapons, which I imagine is their greatest nightmare?
I'm skeptical they can stop transfers completely, but they can reduce both the scale and the scope of the flow. By hitting convoys, by in general trying to disrupt the back and forth between Hezbollah and Syria, Israel might be able to reduce the overall inventory Hezbollah is left with when this whole thing is done, or at least a few years from now. It'll be hard, though, in part because Iran can get weapons to Hezbollah in ways outside of Syria. Syria is not the only path to Lebanon. And also because the volume is considerable, and even if you interdict or destroy a good portion of it, there's still a good portion remaining.
So in your article, Daniel Beiman, in the New York Times, Mr. Obama, Don't Draw That Line, you mentioned Representative Mike Rogers, the Republican from Michigan, I think he's the chair of the Intelligence Committee or is it the Foreign Affairs Committee? I'm not sure which one. But anyway, he's arguing that Iran and North Korea will draw the wrong lessons if the president lets Mr. Assad call his bluff. Walk us through that in terms of how important these things are in terms of what dictates what other countries think of America's resolve.
This is a very tricky issue and to me one of the most important in this whole dispute. It's tempting to see this in black or white terms, that if you draw a red line in one place and fail to enforce it, it'll haunt you for the rest of your administration. Or conversely, if you back one up, that everyone will learn the right lesson. In reality, it's a bit of a mix. What we see with foreign leaders of all sorts is that some draw lessons from their own personal experiences with the United States. Others focus on conflicts in their region or most immediate to them. And in this case, I tend to see it as being more important for Iran than North Korea, just because this is in Iran's neighborhood, and also because Iran and Syria are such close allies. But Iran has lots of experience either fighting the United States or in general confronting it, and this includes Iraq and Afghanistan. It includes decades of hostility. So Iranian leaders' impressions of the United States certainly are formed to a fair degree, but I do think the failure to back up the red line in Syria makes this problem worse. I don't think it makes it dramatically worse, but it adds to the impression that the United States will not always follow up its commitments.
And you cite an historical example of where drawing a red line or the failure to draw a red line may have led to the Korean War, because Secretary of State Dean Acheson declared in 1950 that South Korea was not included in the Asian defense perimeter, that he specifically mentioned countries like Japan and the Philippines. And the assumption is that Moscow took notice of this, that the U.S. didn't declare South Korea as a vital interest, if you will, and that may well have led to the North invading. So just explain that example in the context of the red line over Syria.
What happened in Korea illustrates both the virtues, if you will, of red lines, but also the perils. The virtue is the United States laid out a red line. It included Japan and the Philippines. And in general, the Soviet Union and its allies respected that red line. Because, however, the line was not drawn carefully, it did not include South Korea. And as a result, North Korea and the Soviet Union drew the wrong lesson and invaded, and the United States went to war anyway. And so the lesson for Syria, in some ways, is really to know yourself, to know where the United States will fight, where it will deploy assets, and to make that very clear to Syria. What the United States doesn't want is to have a situation where potentially Syria could have been deterred or scared off from bad behavior, but the United States didn't make that clear, and as a result, both the bad behavior occurred and the United States went to war even though it didn't want to.
Well, but you also point out that the United States may have a distorted or perhaps even inflated notion of its own credibility. I recall, for example, Henry Kissinger trying to keep the Vietnam War going because he felt that U.S. credibility was at stake, that if we pulled out, this would embolden the Soviet Union. And it would seem, in retrospect, that the Soviets were perfectly happy to bleed us via the North Vietnamese, and then we paid them back by bleeding them in Afghanistan. But do we exaggerate this notion of credibility?
At times, yes. And I would say, in general, you don't want to go to war simply for credibility. I think there are a number of reasons the United States should increase its involvement in Syria, and in particular to help the Syrian opposition more. And a lot of them concern the tragedy in Syria. Some concern the spillover to countries like Lebanon and Iraq and the burden it's putting on Jordan. Also the risks of regional war. So in my view, there are very serious U.S. security interests and a very serious humanitarian case to be made for increasing support for the Syrian opposition. In addition to that, there is a credibility concern. But I wouldn't say for credibility reasons alone the United States should dramatically change its policy, but I would say that credibility should be considered in addition to these other factors.
And in your article, Daniel Bowman, in the New York Times, Mr. Obama, Don't Draw That Line, you mention a letter that President George Bush Sr. wrote to the Serbian leader, Milosevic, I imagine, telling him not to intervene militarily in Kosovo, which he eventually did. And 7 years later, finally, President Bill Clinton retaliated. So what's the difference then between these public and private? I mean, if you go to the press conference in the White House press room and point your finger and say, don't cross that line, that's one thing. But in a private letter, what's the difference there?
If you do it publicly, you're committing yourself not only to your enemy, but also to your allies and to your own people. And so typically it's a stronger commitment because if you don't make good on your threat, you're willing to suffer criticism domestically. You're willing to let your allies down. So the advantage of doing it privately is that should you decide later on not to make good on the threat, it's less embarrassing. But all that said, the private warnings are often taken very seriously. Sometimes people look at the public warning and believe it's simply for domestic consumption, and they don't believe it's done seriously. While the private one, the only reason to do it is if you're trying to convey a very strong message. So there are advantages and disadvantages to each.
Well, surely, though, one of the problems we have is that we don't recognize these axes of evil, quoting the Bush Jr. administration. I mean, the countries that have proven the most bothersome were the very ones that we don't have any relationships with. We had no diplomatic relations with Iraq. We have none with Iran. And we have none with North Korea. So you're sort of in the dark, aren't you, in terms of intelligence? But you're also, I guess there are ways to communicate and send letters. But it'd be much, much stronger, would it not, if you actually recognize these people?
Certainly, it's good to have, I think, diplomatic relations in general because it does enable communicating and also communicating threats. I will say in the case of Iran, it's largely been the Iranians that have rejected relations. The United States, under Obama, repeatedly tried to revive a diplomatic track, and the Iranians repeatedly and publicly scorned it. And in the Syria case, the United States did have an ambassador there for many years and certainly had a diplomatic presence, even though relations were often hostile. So in general, it's better to have diplomats there than to not have them there. But I do think we can work around it, and even having them there doesn't always achieve the results we want.
Well, just in closing, Daniel Bowman, how do you think the president's going to get out of this trap, if indeed he did set a trap for himself? Because I think the American people are on his side. They're war-weary, and this is a mess, this place. And I think it's pretty clear that American boots on the ground would be a catastrophe. They'd just be a magnet for more trouble, as they've been in Iraq and Afghanistan.
I think the president will count on several things. One is that over time, the story will simply fade. That whether it's other crises in the region or concerns at home, that people's attention will move on. Also, as you said, the American people don't want intervention. So it's not like he's facing tremendous demands from the majority of Americans to change policy. In fact, quite the opposite. And last, I think he may announce some small changes to current policy that are more aggressive against the Syrian government. And that would be a way of responding and doing so in a high-profile way that would enable him to claim that he did do something and that he did it after deliberation, he did it carefully. And so I think that mix of small symbolic actions plus time will make the difference in his policy.
Well, thank you very much for joining us here today, Daniel Bowman.
Thank you for having me.
Again, I've been speaking with Daniel Bowman, who is a professor in the Security Studies program at Georgetown University and the research director at the Brookings Institution's Center for Middle East Policy. He served on the 9/11 Commission and is the author of A High Price, The Triumphs and Failures of Israeli Counterterrorism. He has an article at the New York Times, Mr. Obama, Don't Draw That Line. This has been Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters. I'd like to thank producer Graham Fitzgibbon. This program's available for podcasting at ianmasters.com, where you can also contact me. And I'll be back again tomorrow at 5 p.m. with another Background Briefing. Bye for now.